This is Mark Lane.
This is Robert Groden.
This is Dick Russell.
This is Jim Mars.
This is Lisa Pease.
This is Dr. David Mantic.
This is Cyril Weck.
This is Jim DiEugenio.
This is Joan Mellon.
This is Jerry Polakoff.
This is Gary Shaw.
This is Greg Burnham.
This is Gerald McKnight.
This is Sherry Feaster.
This is Dave Ratcliffe.
This is Doug Horn.
This is Walt Brown.
This is Bill Pepper.
This is Richard Belzer.
This is Oliver Stone.
This is Governor Jesse Ventura, and you're listening to Black Op Radio.
T-minus 30 seconds.
T-minus
25 seconds.
T-minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go. T-minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T-minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Len Osanek. Today, we are joined by Jim DiEugenio, and we are going to be interviewing author David Talbot. Hello, David.
Hi, Len, and hi, Jim.
Thanks for being taking time to be on the show. You have a new book, The Devil's Chessboard. We're going to discuss that today. Before I get into questions, can you give us a brief background of your writing and interest in this topic?
Well, it came out of my previous book, Brothers, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years, in which I followed Bobby Kennedy's investigative path as he privately explored the assassination of his brother. And I know from my research on that book that Bobby, pretty quickly after the assassination, almost immediately in fact, was looking at the anti-Castro operation run by the CIA as the source of the plot against his own brother. And so I continued to follow that trajectory for the 5 years that Bobby lived until he himself was assassinated in 1968. But Bobby obviously didn't have access to all the information that we later developed, we being the JFK research community and various investigative projects, the House Select Committee on Assassinations and so on in the 1970s. So obviously there was a wealth of new information that Bobby Kennedy, despite the fact that he was an expert investigator and of course was plugged into a lot of corners of American power, but even Bobby didn't have access to the full story, I believe. So I was always haunted by the question, you know, if Bobby continued to pursue the case, what would he have found out? Who was responsible for killing his brother and who should have been put on trial? And so it was in a conversation, actually, with Peter Dale Scott, and I'd begun to think heavily about Alan Dulles, the director of the CIA who was fired by President Kennedy, as my chief culprit for a number of reasons. But it was during a conversation with Peter Dale Scott one day in Berkeley where it all kind of came together, and I tell this story in the book, how Peter mentioned as a young professor at Berkeley, he was invited to a conservative conclave, this dinner held at the home of W. Glenn Campbell, the founder of the Hoover Institute, the right-wing institute here in the Bay Area at Stanford. And this was, I believe, in 1962. It was a very conservative group, and they spent most of the dinner table conversation railing about Kennedy, this weak president who was destroying the country and putting the country at risk and so on. And Peter actually was not that political at that point in his life, and he was kind of astonished as a Canadian, a polite Canadian, and a former diplomat, and that's why he'd been invited to this dinner party. He had served in Poland and knew a number of people in the anti-communist exile community in the United States. But he was kind of shocked at how venomous the conversation was about Kennedy. And finally, a Russian exile priest, who seemed to be the alpha male in the room, got up. Peter didn't remember his name, and kind of quieted everybody and said, "Don't worry, the old man will take care of it." And Peter thought at the time that he was referring to old Joe Kennedy, the patriarch of the Kennedy family, who was supposedly going to get JFK under control. Yeah, but I had known that by that point, Joe Kennedy, of course, was all but incapacitated by a massive stroke he'd had in late 1961, I believe, December 61. And he was in no position to advise his son at that point. But I did know from my research that the old man was the nickname that Alan Dulles was known by within the intelligence community very affectionately, the old man. So that, you know, triggered a series of then thoughts in my mind, and that's really how the sort of the book began to take shape.
Now, this Dulles era, do you want to describe what you think the Dulles era, what people should come away with if you're thinking about John and Alan and what they represented?
Yeah, well, this is the lawless era that America continues to operate within. And in many ways, the Dulles era is the beginning of everything that we're grappling with today. America is perhaps the most dangerous and lawless country in the world. And this precedent was set, the stage was set for this during the Dulles period. Every president virtually that the Dulles brothers served, particularly Alan Dulles, was manipulated by the Dulles brothers, particularly Alan, was subverted. The presidencies were subverted, I would go as far as to say, by the Alan Dulles. All the kind of controversial policies from torture, extraordinary rendition, extralegal assassination, subversion of foreign governments, even foreign allies, massive surveillance of private citizens, on and on down the list, all these things that we associate with the post 9/11 era actually have their origins in the Dulles era.
And I guess that's where the title comes from, because you make the reference there. That I think you're being light on him, just calling him the devil.
Well, I couldn't find any horns on him, but I do think, yes, he symbolized a kind of the evil of power in a way. You know, some people call him a psychopath, you know, and sort of he had this cold amorality, I think. He was able to send people to their death without blinking an eye. He regarded his own children, his own family, with kind of a cold detachment. He, again and again, you know, he put his own son in the hands of MKUltra doctor who performed experimental and very brutal treatments on him. Yeah, I mean, this is a man who's virtually capable of anything.
Yeah. Now, before we get too in-depth here, because that's the good thing about this book, and I really recommend it. I bought the audio version of it, so it's over 24 hours long, so I know that's how long it'll take someone to listen to it. But you go into in-depth from a very almost a childhood and to their family history. But before I get too far in, where can we get the book, and do you have a website that there's more information?
Well, of course, I encourage everyone to buy the book at their independent bookstore. In fact, because of the support of independent bookstores here in California, the book has already become a bestseller in California. And that's despite the kind of media blacklist of the book, at least mainstream media. So I would encourage people to support their independent bookstore, but it's also available on Amazon.
Right, and I got it at audible.com, my copy.
Right.
Okay, Jim, me and Jim both have a series of questions we'd like to bring up, but go ahead, Jim, if you want to start.
On the last go-round, you know, it's really kind of funny because back in the 90s when I started to do a lot of talks on the JFK case and I would get to a certain topic like Mockingbird, I would preface what I was going to talk about and I would say something like this. I would say, like most of the bad things in American life, it began with Alan Dulles. Okay, so I'm really glad that he made that sort of like the coda to his book, you know, that so many of the horrible things that we have to put up with in American life today began with the Dulles brothers, you know.
And I know, and I wasn't the first, obviously, to start to focus on Alan Dulles. Jim, I was aware of, you know, your writing about Dulles as well, and there were a number of other researchers I know who were looking in that direction. But I just felt this had to be given a book-length treatment. But he was emerging, I think, in some circles, including the ones that Jim, you know, frequents, as kind of, you know, leading suspect in the case.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, I believe. He begins the book with a really memorable scene, okay, between Alan Dulles. Was Dulles in Bern in World War II?
Yes, in Switzerland.
Yeah, okay. And he's negotiating with some baron who's the representative of Heinrich Himmler.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and
the Nazi prince, this emissary was called.
Right, and so it's a very great way to begin the book because Talbot says, he goes, Roosevelt had given orders that there would be an unconditional surrender, meaning there was no negotiating with anybody. All right. You know, America and England were going to lay down the law at the end. So here you have Allen Dulles actually disobeying Roosevelt's orders and negotiating off the books with a representative of the SS commander in chief, you know. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a really good way to begin the book, because it shows that Dulles didn't obey anybody's orders. He conducted his own foreign policy according to what he wanted to do. And to hell with everybody else.
Precisely. And I think that's why he wanted to be stationed in Switzerland during the war instead of London, where most of the OSS was, because he knew he would have very little supervision in Bern, Switzerland, because it was closed off. The Nazis had encircled Switzerland. Obviously, it was ostensibly a neutral country, but of course, in many ways, it was collaborating with Nazi Germany. The banks, of course, were laundering Nazi assets and so on. And so he was in heaven there. He was really on his own, by and large. He could defy Roosevelt's policy. And at the same time as he's meeting with these Nazi emissaries who are slipping across the border to talk with him, he's also meeting with brave Germans, like Schindler types, who one man named Edward Schulte, who was a businessman, who saw the beginning of the construction of Auschwitz and frantically crossed the border at risk to his own life to inform Allen Dulles, who was supposedly the representative of the Roosevelt government. And he thought that Dulles then would alert the world and alert the Roosevelt administration to this horror, the final solution that was in the early stages. But Allen Dulles wasn't concerned about the plight of the Jews. He actually sat on that information. We know from reading his cables back to Washington, he never made the plight of the Jews his number one concern. He was indifferent. And what he really was concerned about was making sure that Nazi Germany emerged from World War II as a strong bulwark against the Soviet Union, which he always thought, even during the war, when the Soviet Union was taking the brunt of Hitler's onslaught, he always thought that Russia was the main enemy.
Right.
So he was performing treasonously throughout World War II. As Jim said, he was subverting Roosevelt's policy, the Allied policy of unconditional surrender, and he was doing business with his old friends, because, of course, he and his brother Foster go way back with these Nazis, back to their days at Sullivan and Cromwell on Wall Street, their big law firm, where they have clients like IG Farben, which, of course, is the notorious chemical company, a German company that produced Zyklon B, among other things, the pesticide that was used to exterminate Jews. And they're exchanging, you know, cheery Christmas cards back and forth up into the war years. So, you know, they were quite comfortable, and Allen in particular, associating with the devil.
Yeah, well, isn't your first chapter called The Double Agent?
Exactly. I see him as a double agent.
Right, right. He's working both sides, the Americans and the Germans, as he's in this. And Dad, that's a very good point you brought up, that at Bern, you know, he basically didn't have a lot of supervision, you know, so he could conduct his own foreign policy. You know, any which way he wanted. And as that's a very great title, Double Agent, because, you know, when you go into the whole history of the Dulles brothers, one of the reasons Sullivan and Cromwell was so prosperous is that they had no compunction about dealing with these Nazi companies all the way up. And as David just said, probably actually into the war.
Mm-hmm. Arthur Goldberg, who worked with Dulles in the OSS and later became a Supreme Court justice, said later that the Dulles brothers both should have been put on trial for treason. And I believe if Roosevelt had actually lived and the New Deal had continued into the post-war years, there's a very good chance there would have been a so-called banker's trial, when a number of these bankers and industrialists would have been put on trial for collaboration. You know, Foster, back in New York, still running the law firm during the war, was doing all he could, along with his associates, to hide the assets of Nazi clients of his, so they couldn't be seized as enemy property. There were a number of major American corporations that were collaborating the same way secretly, Standard Oil, General Motors, and so on. So, you know, there would have been a reckoning if that presidency had continued into the post-war years.
I'm not sure if this is in your book, but you probably came across it. Didn't Sullivan and Cromwell set up shell companies for IG Farben?
Yes. So their assets wouldn't be seized
right.
by the Roosevelt government.
Right, right. Now, I don't know if you ran across this. There was a great New York Times article on this in which an investigator in the Senate or something said, after studying Farben, he goes, there's no doubt about it. Farben was Hitler, and Hitler was Farben. That's how yes. important Farben was.
And these companies were interlinked. They would have subsidiaries, German and American companies, that were connected. And so at one point it got so absurd that in hiding these assets, they were protecting these companies. And the technology that America needed to pursue the war, diesel technology, fuel technology, and products were being kept from the U.S. military. So you could say, I mean, that was a direct subversion of the war effort that was being undertaken by corporate clients of the Dulles brothers.
Right.
That's why people like Goldberg later thought they should have been put on trial for treason.
Yeah.
Clearly, they put the interests of their clients, even when they were Nazi-related or Nazis, above the good of the country and the war effort.
Yeah. So, like you clearly delineate in your book, what Dulles was doing in Switzerland there was simply an extension of what he and his brother had been doing for Sullivan and Cromwell.
Yeah, and it continues, of course, till the very end of the war, and this was the other key thing he did. So he engineered something called Operation Sunrise, which was a top-secret plan and had to be secret again because it violated, once again, the official Allied policy of unconditional surrender that had been worked out at the Casablanca conference with Churchill and Roosevelt. Stalin wasn't able to come because he was busy trying to win the Battle of Stalingrad, which was, of course, a turning point in the war. But at that conference, to assure Stalin that he wouldn't be stabbed in the back, Roosevelt very strongly lays out this policy of unconditional surrender. No, we're not going to cut any separate deals with the Nazis. We're going to crush this regime and bring its leaders to justice. But at the end of the war, Dulles is again very busy trying to cut a deal with Nazi forces in Italy, primarily Karl Wolff, who's the former liaison between Hitler and Himmler. You can't get more criminal than that, and is now in charge of all security forces, including the SS, in Italy. But he was a shrewd guy, and he knew his days were numbered. He knew he would end up in a war crimes trial, so he spends the last weeks of the war frantically trying to cut a deal with Dulles. And Dulles, because he's very concerned about stopping the Red Army from overrunning Western Europe and coming into Italy, is very intent on also cutting this deal. And so they do. In the final days of the war, it doesn't really say, Dulles later presented it as a major strategic victory because it stopped bloodshed and destruction in Italy. Well, it really didn't save any lives. It was only 5 days before the general surrender in Germany. The only necks it saved were Karl Wolff, this SS general, his neck, and those of his top aides, all of whom should have been put on trial at Nuremberg. You know, Karl Wolff was responsible for keeping the trains running on time for Hitler to the camps. He ran as the head of the SS in Italy. He tortured and executed Italian partisans. He even tortured and executed American agents, intelligence agents who worked for Dulles. And yet this, you know, he was cutting a deal with this guy. One of his top aides, one of the top people who worked with Karl Wolff in Italy, Walter Rauff, was another notorious war criminal who invented the first tool of the final solution. You know, before the camps were built, what they would do, the Nazis, were they had these mobile trucks that they would run around the battlefields and the front and the Eastern Front and round up Jews and put them in the back of these vans. And they had the gas lines then were attached into the compartment where the Jews were stuffed. And they would gas them to death in these mobile death vans. They're hideous instruments of death. And they were so hideous that the Nazi soldiers who were forced to clean up afterwards were so repelled and sickened by it that they knew they needed a more efficient assembly line of death, which is why they began building the concentration camps. Well, this guy, this is his brainstorm, these mobile death vans, Walter Rauff, ends up in Italy and is hidden away in a luxurious apartment at the end of the war, along with some of these other notorious war criminals, where James Angleton, who's Dulles's, of course, close deputy and later head of counterintelligence under Dulles at the CIA, and really sort of our top intelligence guy in Italy because of his family's roots there, he installs these war criminals there to hide them from American intelligence agents who are searching for them, to put them, you know, so they can face justice. And just as quickly as they would be rounded up and put in jail, Angleton and his associates would let them out the back door. Walter Rauff ends up being tipped off before a raid. He flees. He gets to, I believe he ended his days in Chile, where he worked with the Pinochet government as a top intelligence advisor, and of course on torture and so on. So these were the kind of men that Dulles rescued and rehabilitated after the war.
Now, I guess we should make one more mention here about the end of World War II, and that, of course, is another guy that Dulles was instrumental in getting out of the clutches of Nuremberg, which, of course, is Reinhard Gehlen. And he did a really nice job on Dulles getting him to the baseball game.
Exactly. I began the chapter that way.
Yeah.
Here's Reinhard Gehlen, who was Hitler's top spy on the Eastern Front. And he's sitting at a ball game with his deputy, who, you know, served with Gehlen throughout the war. And it turns out the deputy was a baseball nut, this German, this Nazi. And they're sitting, right, this courtesy of the CIA, they have tickets to the 1951 World Series, the final game of the series where Joe DiMaggio plays his last game. He retired right after that. So they're taking in the game. You know, Dulles later said, well, I know this guy Reinhard Gehlen isn't, you know, the nicest chap, but you don't have to invite him to your club. But, of course, he did invite him to the club. He not only got him World Series tickets, he invited him to his club in Washington whenever he visited. He wined him and dined him. And they exchanged, you know, Christmas cards and birthday cards. And he basically supported him after the war as his rise within the West German power structure and helped install him as the top spy master under Chancellor Konrad Adenauer. So a post that he held throughout much of the Cold War. He was a very powerful figure.
Now, and, David, you mentioned postcards and that. You've gone through a lot of the journals and daily calendars of Alan Dulles. That's something that I don't think a lot of people have ever gotten to get that insight. Can you describe some of the things that you found?
Well, you know, he was very proud of some correspondence. So you think, you know, of course they were heavily purged, these files. So, you know, God knows what Angleton and others burned after Dulles died in 1969. You know, Angleton quickly swooped down along with his other associates, mechanics, CIA mechanics, into Dulles' home in Georgetown and went through all the files and everything. So, yeah, the files that are at Princeton where Alan Dulles' papers are kept, of course, are heavily purged. But it's funny, they, you know, what they allow to stay in those files. And some of the things that are very interesting were his day calendars, and we can talk about that, some of the revealing things in his day calendars that he kept throughout the his life, his career, up until his death. And you know, again, there are some interesting days that are blacked out heavily, like when he went to Dallas in 1963, I believe it was August of 63, and of course Kennedy's killed in November of 63.
No, you know, it was October of 63.
Was it October? Yeah, thank you. Some of the people he was seeing there were blacked out, but you do still get an interesting sense of some of the people he's meeting with and the correspondence. And, of course, he's very proud of some of his correspondence. And now, of course, it's particularly revealing, like, how cozy his relationships were with top media executives and editors and so on. I mean, this guy had the American media totally wired. So it just makes me laugh when people say, well, you know, we live in such a media-saturated society. You know, we know everything about everyone's celebrity sex lives and everything. You know, how could they have possibly conspired to kill the president? The media would have been all over this. That just makes me laugh as a journalist who spent my entire life in media, you know, when I see how the sausage gets made or doesn't get made. I mean, the American media, the press corps, particularly the Washington press corps, are some of the most timid and complicit professionals in the world. And they were very cozy and complicit with Alan Dulles and his regime at the CIA. I mean, many of his files in which there's, you know, letter after letter back and forth between him and the top editors of the New York Times, at the Henry Luce's Time Life Empire, at the Washington Post, at Newsweek, at CBS, on and on. You know, Allie, they're calling me Allie. He has nicknames for them. They're going to see him at the club. You know, it was great to go on vacation with you. One letter from, I quote in the book, from the Newsweek editor right after the Warren Report is released, which, of course, Alan Dulles was heavily involved in as a member of that commission, in fact, someone who dominated that commission. And this editor, I think he was the head of the Washington Bureau of Newsweek at the time, says, "Dear Mr. Dulles, thank you so much for helping direct and, you know, our coverage of the Warren Commission."
Yeah, I just read that this morning. Yeah, that was really funny.
So Dulles, of course, is proud of that stuff. So it's all in his files.
Yeah, and let's not forget, which I think you very wisely made a key point in your book, is the whole Charles Murphy, Henry Luce operation with Dulles and Hunt after the Bay of Pigs, when Dulles realized that Kennedy was going to dump him. okay, over that whole affair. And he got out his cover story with Charles Murphy, you know, at Fortune.
That's right. Charles Murphy was basically his ghostwriter. He in fact, helped write the eulogy for Dulles' funeral.
Really funny.
With Angleton. So here was a guy who was a top reporter in the Loose Empire at Fortune magazine. Right, and he's doing all this ghostwriting for Dulles throughout his career. Until you know, even for his funeral.
I found this day calendar and the appointments, even though they don't have the minutes of what they spoke about, very interesting. And like you mentioned, Dulles, I think a lot of people here are interested to see what kind of ties there are between this intelligence agency run by Allen Dulles and the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And let me pose the question to you this way. Are you surprised in your investigation to find out about Allen Dulles's, quote, retirement? Because you go into in detail that you'd think that he was fired, forced to retire, but what you discover is something entirely different.
Yeah, Len, I think that is one of the key contributions the book makes. I'm not aware of others who've made at least a strong case for this in book form, which is that Allen Dulles didn't get the memo when he was fired by Kennedy. Of course, Kennedy is furious with him after the failed Bay of Pigs invasion, CIA operation in Cuba. His days are numbered after that in April 61. By November, he's officially gone. He's out. And he does go through a brief period of, you know, being a little bit disoriented, and his whole life has been in power, and suddenly he's, you know, supposedly retired at home in Georgetown. But he really bounces back pretty quickly. And he begins to see a steady stream of his top aides, people like Angleton, Helms, and so on, and sort of more the operative types, too, as well. Howard Hunt and others stay in touch. He's going to conferences. He's going to meetings. He's meeting with people at his clubs. He starts to finally speak out against Kennedy. He's, I believe, involved in secret operations that subvert the Kennedy presidency abroad, particularly in Italy, which I go into in the book. And basically what Dulles does in so-called retirement is to set up an anti-Kennedy government in exile out of his home in Georgetown. And some of the people he's meeting with, in fact, are later tied by the House Select Committee on Assassinations, among other investigators, to the murder of the president in Dulles, including Howard Hunt. So,
well, can you go into that a little further? Because it's almost as if John McCone is just keeping the chair warm. And as you reveal, these people are coming and going, and it's like Allen Dulles is still there running the ship.
Yeah, well, John McCone, of course, is this Republican businessman, and he was served in the Eisenhower administration. But he's not a CIA guy. He wasn't one of the old boys. And he basically shared Dulles' worldview and his strong anti-communist perspective, and he kept those policies going. And the Kennedys came to really regret, I quote, this conversation between JFK and Bobby Kennedy in the White House that was taped because JFK had his own taping system. And they're ragging on John McCone. And JFK's realized, of course, what a mistake it was, and saying that he's, you know, stabbing us in the back all over Washington, which was true. You get that sense from Arthur Schlesinger's journals as well. Arthur Schlesinger is going to many of the same parties on the Washington circuit where McCone shows up, and he's like, you know, McCone is openly denouncing Kennedy, everything, his economic policy, his foreign policy, and so on. So he's basically, again, this, you know, wolf inside the Kennedy administration. The Kennedy administration was riddled with anti-Kennedy people. And so McCone's basically, as I say, continuing the Dulles policy, but you know, some of the darker stuff that the Dulles had initiated before McCone replaces him, I don't think McCone fully was even aware of. I think Helms, you know, and Angleton were running that. Dulles was, you know, they were probably keeping Dulles in the loop. But McCone, I think, you know, didn't want to know and was kept out of the loop. But so, yeah, the Dulles policy continued to go on even after Dulles left.
Well, specifically in the book, which, again, this is something. And by the way, let me add here, as the author just noted, you know, I had done a lot of work on Allen Dulles myself, but I really have to say there was a lot of things in this book that not only was I not aware of, but I was really surprised, you know, that David found it. Okay, this one I'm going to refer to now is in the book, you have him raising money through some business interests for a secret invasion of Cuba by the Cuban exiles in 1963? That's correct, isn't it?
Yeah, is this, you mean Paulino Sierra Martinez are you referring to?
Yes, right.
Yeah, so he is this former Batista thug, basically. Some people, even in his family, thought he was an assassin, posed undercover for Batista, serving in some ministerial role for Batista that allowed him to go overseas. Batista, of course, is the mafia-connected, corrupt thug, is the best word for him, who ran Cuba before Fidel Castro. And so Paulina Sierra Martinez, you know, serves the Batista government, flees after Castro takes over, ends up in Florida with his family. He gets his law degree in the U.S. and ends up working for a Rockefeller-connected company in Chicago. Is it Union Tank Car? And starts raising money after the Bay of Pigs invasion when it looks like the anti-Castro movement has been cut off by the Kennedy administration, is kind of at loose ends and is in something of disarray. Sierra Martinez comes into that vacuum at that point in late 62, I believe, and he starts to make connections to the mafia. He's making connections with U.S. corporations that have had a big stake in Cuba and had lost their assets after Castro took over. And he meets with Alan Dulles. And all we know is from the House Select Committee on Assassinations dug up this document that showed that he had met with Dulles. But here's a former CIA director who really moved in, you know, pretty high echelons, I mean, with the top people in corporate and political America. And suddenly he's meeting with this guy who was a former Batista hitman who's now raising money for an invasion, a new invasion of Cuba. So obviously this was not only in contravention of Kennedy policy at the time, who was withdrawing support more and more from the anti-Castro exile movement, but it was a bizarre sort of clash of two different social orders. You know, these weren't the kind of guys that Dulles normally hung out with. So that's kind of a mysterious meeting. Later, the Secret Service connects Sierra Martinez to a plot against JFK. And this, too, comes out during the House Select Committee investigation. And this is never fully explained, how he was involved in this plot and so on. The Secret Service wanted to pursue that investigation after Kennedy's assassination, but the FBI cut them off and said, basically, this is our investigation, you know, butt out.
Yeah, you made the connection to the Homer Echeverria incident, right?
Exactly. He was involved with, Sierra Martinez was involved with him.
Yeah, which makes people, well, I think you actually put it in your book. Is this part of the Chicago plot? Did you come to any conclusions on that?
I believe that's what the Secret Service was on to, right? And of course, we know that one of the more diligent people in the Secret Service, Abe Bolden, right, was working out of Chicago.
Right.
So that was the suspicion at the time, but the FBI shut down that investigation after Dulles. But again, it's just these are some many of the one, just one of the many curious people that Alan Dulles is meeting with. So the book has been attacked here and there by people in the mainstream press for, one said, it was for being animated by conspiracy theories. But
well, you know, we don't even have to go into that because I've read some of those and they are without merit and they're gutless and they're really so ill-informed as to make them pointless.
They were unable to really engage with me in any detailed way because they are uninformed, often, these critics. They just are sort of mouthing what they've heard for years. And, of course, this is a way of shutting down legitimate investigation into these dark corners of our history. But the point is, you know, everything in this book, it's a process of inductive reasoning, you know, to go back to Sherlock Holmes. Are there smoking guns that the CIA left around saying Alan Dulles was the mastermind of this? No, that's not the way they work. But once you enter a world that is this shadowy, the best you can do is to compile pieces of evidence and at the end come to an educated conclusion about all these hundreds and hundreds of pieces of evidence that I do put together in the book.
Oh, yeah. It's a very big book. Like I said, even just the audio version is 24 hours. But you leave this trail of meetings and insinuation where there's not going to be a paper trail if Dulles is meeting with Martinez there. Just the fact that they met and then you discover who the Sierra Martinez is and what he's been doing.
Well, and the other key assassin that you have to investigate in the context of Dulles is William Harvey. So we all know that name. You know, he's been a figure of great suspicion in the Kennedy case for many years, going back to the 70s. And basically, when you look at it, who was William Harvey? William Harvey was the guy that Dulles put in charge of the assassination operation, that later was exposed by the Church Committee and other investigations in the 70s. This was the operation that targeted foreign leaders. And, of course, the CIA story at the time when went before Congress to investigate it, to answer these charges in the 70s, was, well, we were the gang that couldn't shoot straight. We tried to kill these guys like Lumumba and others, but, you know, we didn't really pull it off, and they ended up getting killed some other way. But the truth is they were much more effective than they let on. Lumumba indeed was killed by CIA contractors. And we don't know the full list of all the many people the CIA was killing in those years through the Cold War. We know that there was a death list after the Arbenz government was overthrown in Guatemala that included not just Arbenz, who did die under mysterious circumstances in exile, scalded to death in a bathtub in Mexico City. But we know that there were dozens and dozens of other people who are not even known to us, other opposition political leaders, journalists, union officials, farm worker organizers, many of whom ended up dead. And
well, yeah, you tell the story of Jose de Galinda.
By the way, that's on my list, too. This is the guy who wanted to expose Trujillo, right?
This is Jesus de Galinda, who was a Basque exile. He fled Franco after the war, ended up jumping out of the frying pan into the fire, ending up in the Dominican Republic during the Trujillo dictatorship, worked briefly for the Trujillo government, and then fled there to New York City and became a prominent critic of Trujillo, who ran probably one of the most vicious dictatorships of the era. And he became an academic at Columbia University and was getting his PhD there. And his PhD dissertation was a inside critique, an indictment of the Trujillo regime. And Trujillo got wind of this. He had his agents everywhere, and they tried to buy the thesis from him before he could complete it, but he refused. And one day, after he had taught class at Columbia, he was headed back home to his apartment in Manhattan, and he was grabbed. And this, in one of the, I think, the first cases of CIA extraordinary rendition, he was grabbed by, again, CIA contractors working for Robert Mayhew, who was the detective who worked as a CIA cutout in the United States, because by law, the CIA was forbidden from operating on U.S. soil, so they used cutouts like Mayhew's detective agency. They grabbed this professor, got him out to Long Island, drugged him, put him on an airplane, flew him to Dominican Republic, where he was horribly tortured and executed by Trujillo's security people. So this is what later became known as extraordinary rendition, and it happened under Dulles.
And then another thing that you brought up, which, again, I'd been aware of, but you went into it a lot more depth than I've ever seen in the Kennedy research community, was a whole attempt of the CIA to encourage and help the OAS overthrow de Gaulle. And by the way, this is one of the things you've been criticized about, right?
Yeah. The Chronicle, San Francisco Chronicle criticized me for this because they said, well, my only sources were the French press at the time. Well, number one, there's no reason to suspect the French press was inaccurate, and this critic had no evidence that these reports in the French press were inaccurate. And number two, used other multiple sources for this, not just the reports in the French press at the time. And the reason those reports were in the French press was because the de Gaulle's government itself was leaking to them. So here's an ally of ours, Charles de Gaulle, war hero, conservative, Catholic, not exactly, you know, kind of the communist types, supposedly, that we were going around the world overthrowing. But he'd fallen into disfavor with the hardliners like Dulles in Washington because he was trying to settle the long, bloody colonial war, French colonial war, in Algeria. And he was also he was very nationalistic and proud, and he was trying to steer his own direction and not be under the thumb of NATO. And so they resented this and decided that he had to go. So his efforts, de Gaulle's efforts to settle the war in Algeria, sets off a backlash from right-wing French generals there. And in April 1961, as poor JFK is still wrestling with the Bay of Pigs fiasco that the CIA has dumped in his lap, he's now forced to deal with another crisis instigated by the CIA when he starts getting outraged phone calls and howls of outrage from the de Gaulle government saying, what the hell is going on? Are you supporting this coup attempt against me? And they're expecting, troops from Algeria to begin descending in parachutes over Paris at any minute. There are rebellious tank units gathering in force outside of Paris. It's one of the most dramatic moments in the history of French democracy in the 20th century. And so JFK is put in the very awkward position of saying, no, I have nothing to do with this coup, but I can't speak for my own CIA. So imagine that, the President of the United States telling a key ally, Charles de Gaulle in France, that I cannot speak for my own CIA, and that's what the French ambassador communicates back to Paris. De Gaulle is able, finally, by rallying the French people, it's a very dramatic thing, going on television, people pour into the streets, they basically face down this mutinous military action, and he wins the day. It's an amazing moment. And yes, it hasn't really been reported in this country, except at the time. What the Chronicle criticized me for this didn't mention is that even the New York Times was covering it at the time, James Reston in his column saying that the CIA has gone too far. They seem to be supporting this coup against, you know, de Gaulle. So this was widely reported on at the time, and there was government documents I used also at the time, French and American, to support the fact that this was happening. De Gaulle, of course, after Kennedy's killed, later comes home from the funeral in Washington and tells his own information minister, well, Kennedy was killed by the same U.S. security forces that tried to kill me, which is a remarkable statement. And he goes on at length and he says, but the United States will never be able, officials, the United States will never let this come out. It would cause rioting in the streets. It would, you know, there'd be a civil war in the U.S. And so they'll never let this come out. And Oswald is a convenient fall guy. And it's fascinating, his observations and about this, as someone who's himself has been at war with his own right wing and with U.S. security forces and has been the target many times of assassination efforts, including the famous Day of the Jackal sniper attack on his motorcade, very similar to Dallas in some ways, that he survives because his security team was loyal to him. So, you know, there's many interesting corners of history in the book.
When you started quoting that interview with de Gaulle, which I had never seen before, I'm reading this and I go, I wonder, was de Gaulle talking to Castro? Because it so much resembled what Castro said the day after the assassination. You know, it was almost like they compared notes. This is what really happened. This is a bunch of BS what they're saying in the, you know, in the United States. You know, so you got this one conservative guy from Europe and you got this communist guy in the Caribbean saying the same thing about what just happened 24 hours before.
Well, of course, the political elites all around the world said one thing for public consumption and then another thing among themselves. And de Gaulle is one case of this. Nixon was another case. I write about this more actually in Brothers, where LBJ, Nixon, de Gaulle, you know, Bobby Kennedy, they all immediately suspected a plot and they were convinced it was a plot. But of course, they all went along with the Warren Report as a convenient way to put the public's fears to rest. So, yeah, I mean, they all knew what happened. I mean, anyone who, like, particularly like a de Gaulle, who was very well aware of how security forces work and how they undermine democracies and how they often work with organized crime to do their dirty work, he knew it all. And he laid it all out for his information minister, who wrote about it in his memoir. And you're right. It was widely, of course, published. It was a bestseller in France, this information minister's book, his memoirs of working for de Gaulle. But it was the very briefest of quotes that hit the wires in the U.S. when this book was published, and that was it. So that's what all happens all too often. I don't speak French, but I worked with a French researcher who translated the book for me and other French sources. So it's amazing, even in the internet day, how sometimes, you know, these things, vital pieces of information like this, do get lost in translation.
I have a question here, though. You know, Victor Krulak had written to Fletcher Prouty identifying Ed Lansdale in Dealey Plaza. You have William Harvey in Dallas weeks before. Can you talk about this idea that the CIA has created this killing machine? And I think the observation that this whole task force aimed at Castro was turned around. And Dulles went in and met with these guys and said, we got new orders now.
Yeah, you know, sometimes I think even our own research community gets lost down these rabbit holes and we make things too complicated. But I think now 50 some years on, the best of our, you know, researchers and investigators can begin to agree on the big picture stuff. And to me, that's what I try to do with this book. I say, look, let's, you know, it's pretty obvious at this point. What happened was that the CIA under Allen Dulles did build a killing team. It built an assassination kill team that was used all around the world. And that kill team, in one form or another, came back, was brought back to Dallas to kill our own president. And it shouldn't be a surprise to people that, you know, when you create a beast like we did, this killing beast, and you put it in other people's backyards, to use an analogy that Hillary Clinton used in a different context not long ago, that beast is going to enter your own home at some point, which is what it did in Dallas. So what happened was this. We now know that Howard Hunt, by his own admission, was involved in that crime. His son is convinced of it on his deathbed. He basically made a veiled confession. We now know that David Morales, another key assassin for the CIA, was also, by his own admission, in Dallas. And now I put William Harvey, who maybe is the most important person to put in Dallas, from the point of view of proving a conspiracy. As I was talking about earlier, William Harvey was, you know, a known thug and gun-loving head of the CIA's assassination operation, who was put in charge of that by Dulles. And he takes it over at some point early in the Kennedy administration, this operation that was inherited, you know, that was a holdover from the Eisenhower years, and that I believe that the Kennedys were unaware of at the time and had not authorized. In fact, when Bobby Kennedy is finally told about in May 62, he's outraged because, of course, he spent most of his life fighting the mafia, and suddenly he's being told by the CIA that they're working hand in glove to kill Castro. And he believed he'd stopped it at that point, but it did continue. In fact, at the very time that the CIA was telling Bobby Kennedy that they had pulled the plug on it, William Harvey was handing poison pills to his mafia friends to kill Castro. So Harvey is a very central figure because he's head of Allen Dulles' kill team. And when he finally falls afoul of the Kennedy brothers, they hate each other, and Harvey sends in a raiding team at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis that could have triggered World War III. And when Bobby hears about this, he's so furious that Harvey's patrons at the CIA realize to save his career, they got to get him out of the U.S. and got to get him away from the Kennedys. So they send him to Rome, where he becomes station chief. And what the new information I have is from his deputy, Mark Wyatt, who was a career CIA official and a good one by all accounts, loved Italy, spoke Italian fluently. He and his wife had met there and married there. And if Harvey is sort of the ugly American, you know, a guy like Mark Wyatt is one of the decent ones. But he is working under Harvey, and he realizes this guy is dangerous. Among other things, Harvey's proposing to him that they recruit mobsters, mafia people in Italy, to kill Italian Communist Party officials. And Wyatt can't believe it. And they argue violently again and again. At one point, Harvey even draws a gun on Wyatt. Now, this is all from his, Wyatt is now dead, but from his grown children, three of whom I interviewed, all three of them, and from an investigative journalist named Fabrizio Calvi, who's a very respected investigative journalist in Europe, who interviewed Wyatt before he died at his retirement home in Lake Tahoe, who told him as he was leaving, you know, I've often wondered why Bill Harvey was in Dallas in November 63. Well, Calvi, this investigative journalist, knew enough about the Kennedy assassination to know that was an astounding thing, and so he asked him more about it. And apparently, Wyatt said he was on a plane going from Rome to Dallas in November 63, and he sees his boss, Harvey, there, and he asked him, why are you going to Dallas, Bill? And he was very vague, and he said, well, I'm just going to look around or something like that. So his own deputy, Bill Harvey's own deputy, told his children, his grown children, before he died, he was convinced that Bill Harvey was some way involved in the Kennedy assassination, not based just solely on that sighting, but on other things that Harvey told him in Rome. I believe that Harvey did play a key role there. That's what Howard Hunt said as well, that maybe he was the guy who was in charge of bringing in the killers or the guns. Who knows? But we now have his deputy placing him in Dallas in November 63. So this is another, I think, remarkable piece of evidence. So that's what I fundamentally believe. I believe that Dulles' kill team was brought home to kill our own president.
So let's just get it out on the record. You got Dulles in Dallas 3 or 4 weeks before the assassination. You got David Phillips in Dallas admitting this to his brother before he died.
And meeting with Oswald, according to Antonio Vecchiana, anti-Castro Cuban leader.
You got Hunt, and now you have Harvey. So were they all Cowboys?
And David Morales.
Yeah. What were they all doing there? I mean, is it just a coincidence?
And by the way,
very strange.
Yeah. And by the way, I tried to nail this down further by petitioning the CIA through the Freedom of Information Act for Bill Harvey's travel vouchers to prove that he was actually in Dallas and that he was flying from Rome to Dallas in November 63. And, of course, they stonewalled me and refused to release those records.
What was the grounds on which they refused to give them to you?
That they weren't relevant.
You know, are you serious?
Jim Lazar, who's, of course, the indefatigable, you know, Washington attorney who's gone after the CIA again and again for many, on behalf of many investigators, researchers, he was my attorney on it. Yeah, and they either, you know, run down the game clock, and so you have to go to press with your book before they get back to you, or they give some vague responses. And that's happened to me again and again. I've never been able to get anything out of the CIA.
You know, if they would have said that to me in court, I think would have fallen down laughing. It's not relevant if Harvey was in Dallas before the assassination. Oh my God! Yeah, wow. Then the other thing, of course, you have in there, which I think is so fascinating, is that Dulles, on the night of the assassination, begins a 2-day sojourn at the farm. So why don't you explain what the farm is and why that's so odd that he would go there?
Yeah, the farm, which is also known as Camp Peary, is a high-security facility that is operated, I think, still to this day in Northern Virginia by the CIA. Dan Hardway, the House Select Committee, former investigator for the House Select Committee on Assassination, called it basically an alternative command post that Allen Dulles set up for himself. And he actually had a very comfortable, nice house built for himself right on the base. It was used, according to other CIA sources, including Philip Agee and others, as a training center for foreign operatives and an interrogation center for people who had fallen into CIA hands, even as an assassination training center. So, very interesting, you know, site for Allen Dulles suddenly to show up at the weekend that President Kennedy is killed in Dallas, and that Jack Ruby then kills Lee Harvey Oswald. A lot going on that weekend. And so here's a retired CIA official who supposedly has no professional connection to the U.S. government at that point. He's been fired by Kennedy 2 years before. He's supposedly retired. And yet he's not at home watching the events in Dallas like the rest of Americans. He's at a CIA facility. And he puts this in his own day calendar. He's there at the farm, as it was called, for that entire weekend. So, yeah, this is obviously a provocative piece of information. And, you know, we don't know for certain and probably never will what he was doing there, but there he was.
And then you follow this up with another very, very fascinating tidbit that somehow, you know, LBJ just didn't pull Allen Dulles' name out of space. Allen Dulles actually had a lobbying campaign to get on the Warren Commission.
Absolutely. Well, of course, you know, the story that LBJ himself told that then other people picked up, including Robert Caro, who should know better, the historian who spent, you know, volume after volume, you know, detailing all the deceitful ways of Lyndon Johnson. And yet he takes this one at face value. And Lyndon Johnson wrote in his memoir, oh, yeah, Bobby Kennedy wanted me to appoint Allen Dulles to the Warren Commission. Well, to me, this is absurd for a number of reasons. One is that Lyndon Johnson would confer that closely with Bobby Kennedy about such a delicate issue as who he was going to put on the Warren Commission, an investigation that might have sealed his own fate. Bobby Kennedy, of course, and Lyndon Johnson were notorious political enemies. They despised one another. And so he's not going to be taking that kind of political advice from Bobby. Number two, the idea that Bobby would himself urge LBJ to take Dulles is also highly suspect. Again, Bobby kept a list of all the enemies and knew that Dulles was an archenemy of his brother. He'd been fired. In fact, it was Bobby who insisted that all Dulleses be cleansed, be purged from the Kennedy administration after the Bay of Pigs, including Allen's sister, Eleanor, who worked at the State Department. He went to Dean Rusk, Secretary of State, and said, get rid of all the Dulleses. So the idea that Bobby Kennedy, who said, get rid of all the Dulleses, is going to want Allen Dulles to serve on the investigation of his brother's murder, I mean, please. So, but this gets repeated endlessly. Now, Phil Shannon, the former New York Times reporter, we can talk about him later, what he's all about, you know, repeated it recently in his article in Politico. that's been causing a lot of controversy. So it's one of these endless, I think, CIA kind of tropes that gets repeated over and over again. Because, of course, if you have Bobby Kennedy, you know, blessing Alan Dulles, then somehow, of course, this gives some legitimacy to the whole Warren investigation. No, it was, you know, he strong-armed people. He had intermediaries go to LBJ, this is Dulles, to say he got to put Dulles on the commission. Richard Helms said this himself, you know, his right-hand man at the CIA. You know, I quote two or three sources on this, that Alan Dulles worked very hard behind the scenes to get Johnson
Corson,
to the point.
Corson.
Yeah, including Bill Corson, who was sort of a Marine guy who was connected to the CIA, who, you know, was very close to the Dulles family. Corson himself said Dulles went all out, you know, to get on that commission.
And then, of course, you know, the capper is that once he gets on the commission, he becomes the single most active member of the Warren Commission because he was the only guy that didn't have a job.
Exactly. He didn't have a day job. So the senators and the Congress people, right, are shuttling back and forth to the Capitol building doing their business all during the Warren investigation. Earl Warren himself is still sitting on the Supreme Court as Chief Justice, so he has a busy job. John McCloy was still employed elsewhere, the banker diplomat, but he had a little more time, and I think he and Dulles are the two most significant figures. If you read the minutes from those hearings, and followed closely by Jerry Ford, who I think was the FBI's man on the commission, who was a young congressman at the time. I think those three are the ones who really control, and you can see it from the very beginning, because the most important decision the Warren Commission makes early on is who's going to be chief counsel, because, of course, that's a very key, sensitive post, the person who really is going to day-to-day run the investigation. And that turned out to be J. Lee Rankin, of course, who was, you know, someone who was closely associated with the Dulles wing of the Republican Party and someone that Dulles wanted in that post, while Earl Warren himself had wanted Warren Olney, who had served with him in the Eisenhower Justice Department and was someone he trusted. But those three, Ford, McCloy, and Dulles, joined forces to block Earl Warren's choice, and they installed their own instead.
Well, I was going to ask you, with this in-depth of research, how long did it take you when you started writing to get this book out?
Well, you know, in some ways it flowed from the brothers, which took about 4 years, or even longer, 4 or 5 years, to because I was starting from scratch there. With Dulles, I had sort of more of a head start because of my previous work on Brothers, but it took 3 years. And I also should give a shout-out here to Karen Croft, who is my right-hand person on all my books and works with me closely on research on all the books. And there's no way I could have done it in 3 years without Karen's help. So it took us, 3 years, research and writing.
Because it sounds like you've traveled around the world for these interviews.
Well, we did. We went to We had some interesting sources in Italy because I tell an interesting story there. And there's an investigative magistrate, Paolo Mascheloni, who's done some very important investigative work on sort of the deep state in Italy and the CIA. And Mascheloni had some important information for us about Alan Dulles and the CIA in Italy and how they tried to subvert Kennedy policy there. And, yeah, so we went far afield on this. But, of course, Joan Dulles, or Joan Talley is the married name, Dulles' daughter, is another interesting source. Siri Hari Angleton, James Angleton's daughter, both of whom live in New Mexico. We went down there and spent time with them. Often, you know, because virtually all these people are dead, of course, the main characters in the book, their children turn out to be sometimes interesting sources of information. And in Joan's case, she not only gave us interviews at great length, interviewed her many times, but also kind of turned us on to her mother's diaries and correspondence, which were very revealing, and also the correspondence and diaries of Mary Bancroft, who was not only her mother's friend, but Alan Dulles' mistress. So I think that, you know, from a personal point of view, was very important as well.
Yeah, you know, because we've heard a lot about John F. Kennedy having all these flings and that. And when you look at Alan Dulles, you think of this college professor or something, you know, it seems that he's even more of a flander than John F. Kennedy. I mean, do you want to comment on that or what's your opinion?
Yeah, I think he was definitely, you know, thought of himself as a ladies' man. At one point, he was bragging to his mistress that he'd slept with 10 women. Maybe JFK could have outnumbered him on that one, and his mistress thought that was kind of a small number. But I found even more, actually, what was more to me telling about Alan Dulles was not, you know, his adulterous relationship, so much as the way he related to his own family. And Joan said, you know, that he had this kind of, the way she described him and his relationships to his own children was this guy who related to his children as they were guests somehow in his own house. He had this kind of, you know, cold detachment from everyone around him who was he was supposedly close to. On the surface, he could be very charming. You know, he was the life of the party and all that. But underneath was this kind of cold detachment, is the best way of putting it. And, you know, Karen, my colleague, you know, came to think that he was a psychopath based on just, you know, many of the things that we saw him do in his personal life and political life.
Well, do I have this correct that he was writing letters back to his wife bragging of flings that he had?
Yeah, I mean, he put his... I think, you know, Clover Dulles, his wife, was a very sensitive, artistic woman. She was not meant to be married to a man like Alan Dulles. She was unclear why she'd even fallen into his clutches. She could never explain, really, why she even married him. But he kind of laid siege to her and married her within, like, after 3 weeks or something after they got together. So she was always, I think, confused by him and finally said, very sadly, very painfully, in one of her diaries late in her life, you know, this man doesn't say anything to me. He never talks to me about anything, not just about his work, but about anything. And, you know, we know that he later tried to steer her into the hands of Dr. Donald Ewan Cameron, who was probably the most notorious figures in the MKUltra program, this mad scientist who ran the so-called sleep room experiments up at McGill University, where, you know, these poor unsuspecting patients, many of them just suffering from sort of garden variety nervous disorders, postpartum depression or whatever, mostly women, were put in the clutches of this mad scientist who was conducting mind control experimentation on behalf of the CIA and involved putting these people in these deep sleep states through overdoses of drugs where they would be played endless tape loops to try and erase their minds and replace bad thoughts with good thoughts. I mean, we're talking about really barbaric stuff. And Dulles, at one point, you know, she, Clover Dulles, who was very distraught about the marriage, was put in touch with Cameron, and he wanted her to come up to Canada. And fortunately for her, she didn't. But their son, Alan Dulles Jr., who came back from the Korean War with a brain injury after sustaining a wound there, he unfortunately was put in the hands of an MKUltra scientist who subjected him to experimental insulin overdose therapy, which is a very brutal treatment that involves convulsions and in some cases even death. You know, Joan witnessed this when she went to visit him in this New York hospital where Alan Jr. was put, and he was begging her to get him out of there, and she said it was a very traumatic experience.
Well, you called Alan the psychopath, and his wife and mistress had a nickname for him, the Shark.
That's right. That's what they called him. Sort of affectionately, I guess, but it's very telling. Yeah, I mean, he was a shark. He was, you know, driving relentlessly forward, this cold guy who really saw people, and that's why I use the image of chessboard in the title. And it comes up again and again. You know, he talks about that, but he really, and his brother, I think, who loved playing chess against each other and kind of blocked out the whole world while they were playing chess, really saw the world as their chessboard, saw people as pawns. I found this really fascinating when I read his oral history. And imagine what kind of psychopath who, as I make the case for, and if you do believe this, that he was responsible for playing a central role in the assassination of Kennedy, and then sends condolence letters to the Kennedy family. That was chilling. After each Kennedy is killed, you know, he sends condolence letters after Bobby is killed to Teddy and so on, and after JFK to Bobby. But he then gave an interview to the JFK Library, and he sits down with his friend, his buddy Tom Braden from the CIA for this oral history, and he's talking about, oh, yeah, JFK had lived, he might have been a great president, you know, and he puts on this mask of, you know, kind of grief, and then it always was a mask with Dulles. But then he's talking about the actual operation at the end of this interview. And you can't help but feel the excitement and satisfaction that he got from the operation of a lifetime. And you just, you know, you sense that, like, he would love to just brag about this thing. We pulled this off. Because he loved ops. That was the thing that really turned on Alan Dulles. And the way he's talking about it in this Kennedy oral history is like, well, it was like you know, the mechanism of the fine watch, that everything had to work just perfectly. And he talks about it like almost like a chess game. He, I think, uses that metaphor at one point. Every piece had to be moved properly for Kennedy to be killed that day by, and he's saying, of course, by Oswald. But I think he's really saying is by the CIA masterminds who put this thing together. So it's, you know, deeply creepy.
Well, you know, another thing, you talk about Dulles having this mask. A conversation which I was not aware of was, I think you mentioned secondary guy, subordinate, Dick Drain.
Yeah, who worked on the Bay of Pigs operation.
Right. Maybe you should just discuss that briefly. Dulles is out of the country, and he's flying back home, and here is he's going to be briefed by someone who's going to tell him that all hell's broken loose, everything's gone wrong. And just give us a brief insight into that, because that's almost worth the book alone. Again, there's so many things that are just of interest and telltale of the Dulles mind.
Yeah, well, Dick Drain is like thunderstruck, as you say, because he picks Dulles up at the airport. He thinks Dulles is going to be eager to hear every detail about what's going on, so he can, you know, Dulles can get back to President Kennedy and maybe urge him to take action or whatever it is. And yet he seems kind of sublimely indifferent. And he drives him back to his home in Georgetown, and Dulles invites him in for a drink, and he thinks, okay, now we're going to get down to business. And still, it's like, you know, he's asking Drain about other things, like, well, I'm supposed to go to the White House tomorrow to meet, the president of Greece. You were in Greece, Dick, weren't you? You know, can you tell me a little bit about him? And so on. So just seems to be completely indifferent to this unfolding crisis in Cuba that's about to bring down his career. Well, here's what I think was going on with that. And I think this is indisputable at this point. I think the CIA knew, and Dulles knew, that this motley brigade of Cuban exiles was doomed to fail. These 1,100 guys who were being landed on the beaches, they were being sent as cannon fodder to their deaths, to their doom, because what we know from the CIA's own internal reports on this that were done by Lyman Kirkpatrick, the inspector general after, and by a CIA historian later, that Dulles had stocked the Cuban operation with the C-level guys, the worst guys in the CIA. That's what they were called in their own CIA internal reports. So Dulles had gone around saying, yeah, well, we're only going to have the best for this operation. But in fact, he put the losers in charge of that. And the people that should have been there, including one who had literally written the book Amphibian Operations on Landings, because he had experienced a lot himself during World War II in the Pacific, he was kept away from it. So the CIA veterans couldn't believe this. But I think the plan was it was supposed to fail and then, of course, force Kennedy's hand at the height of the crisis, and forced Kennedy into sending in the full power of the U.S. military to save this debacle. And Kennedy, of course, doesn't do that. He stands his ground. He never wanted to do this in the first place. He felt sandbagged that he had to do it to avoid a major political, you know, backlash if he pulled the plug on it, since it had gone on so long. But he's not going to expand it into an all-out military operation, and he pulls the plug. So that's the astonishing thing to Dulles, that Plan B didn't work. Plan B was for Kennedy to be forced into sending in the Marines and the Air Force. But the actual operation that he'd mounted was a loser operation and was meant to fail.
In the space of less than a year, because Dulles leaves in November of 61, you have Kennedy versus Dulles on Congo. Then you have Kennedy versus Dulles at the Bay of Pigs. And you have Kennedy versus Dulles with the OAS in France. And by the end of that, it's pretty much Kennedy realizes he's made a mistake. He should have never let this guy on, never let him stay there, you know. And so then he essentially, him and his brother, with some help, I think you state some help from Schlesinger, you know, they decide that Dulles has to go and that the CIA has to be reorganized. In fact, that was very interesting, the segment you had on Schlesinger. It's something I didn't know, that Kennedy had actually tasked Schlesinger with doing a reorganizing plan for the CIA.
Yeah, I was really interested to come across that too. You know, I had told the story of how the Kennedy presidency had split in two in my book, Brothers. And so I knew I needed to address that again in this book, but I didn't want to just repeat myself. So I was looking for a new narrative way to tell that story in a fresh way. And when I came across Arthur Schlesinger's journals, some of which were collected and published by his sons, but a lot of the material was not. And so the full journals were at the New York Public Library. And when I came across those, that was my sort of light bulb, because Schlesinger, I think, is a fascinating fly on the wall during the Kennedy presidency. On the one hand, he has one foot in the CIA world. He socializes with these guys. He's former OSS. He's buddies with Dick Helms and other CIA guys. They're part of the same Georgetown party circuit. On the other hand, of course, he is loyal to Kennedy. He's this new frontiersman, and he's kind of in the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, and he advises Kennedy not to go ahead with the Bay of Pigs. So he's becoming more and more of a critic of the national security hardliners while he's serving in the Kennedy White House. And he happens to be a great writer. So he keeps these very meticulous daily diaries, which, as I say, are at the New York Public Library. So as I'm reading these day-to-day entries, you can see Schlesinger starting to break away more and more slowly from his CIA people and side more and more with the Kennedy White House and realized, you know, particularly at the Bay of Pigs, that this thing's out of control. The CIA is out of control. The Kennedy administration, if it's going to succeed and control its own foreign policy, needs to discipline this, you know, out-of-control agency and get control of it. So he makes a bid to Kennedy after the Bay of Pigs and says, hey, I know you want, you know, he famously said, Kennedy, I want to shatter the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter into the wind. So he was so mad. But Schlesinger says, look, put me in charge of this reform effort and I'll oversee the overhaul of the CIA. And he throws himself into it. And you see from his files at the Kennedy Library all his research that he's doing into the CIA. And he's interviewing people. He's gathering all this material. And, of course, because he is a liberal, I mean, a lot of his materials are from The Nation magazine. They're from The New Republic. They're from critics on the left of the CIA. And his final sort of proposal is this detailed proposal for what to do with the CIA. And it's pretty extensive. Number one, he wants to take the name CIA off this agency because he thinks it's been so tarnished. It's a bad brand. He wants to break it up into different components. He wants to put it much more firmly under the control of the White House and the State Department. So he basically wants to take this rogue agency that Harry Truman himself, who created it, and others are now worried is become this out-of-control force in American life, and break it into different pieces and really put it firmly under Democratic control. And he presents this to Kennedy, and, of course, there's major pushback from the agency and from people like Maxwell Taylor, who's, you know, has now become a military advisor to Kennedy in the White House, and from the whole sort of national security wing. And, you know, Schlesinger's efforts are defeated. But that's a really interesting story about this internal sort of upheaval that's going on within the Kennedy presidency after the Bay of Pigs.
Did Schlesinger have sort of, he seemed to me that he was really unable to handle looking at the facts of the assassination. And I think that's a real letdown. Do you have any comments about that?
Yeah, you know, I think Arthur Schlesinger is a fascinating guy. And I do try and tell his story because he was a really bright guy. And he knew intellectually, he knew in his head what had happened. He told me, I interviewed
him
twice.
Well, but see... Okay, good, but you're making a case for him. And as I read, I mean, it's like people are clinging to every word he says, saying, see, you can never be sure. But if you take the idea that he knew and he couldn't handle it.
He knew and he couldn't handle it. That's exactly right. I think he knew there was a conspiracy. I think he basically said this to people, but he then... For public consumption, he would phrase it this way. He said, I'm an agnostic when it comes to the question of a conspiracy. So it's a coward's way out. Because he knew if he were to come right out and say, look, obviously this is a conspiracy and it was, you know, it came out of the CIA and the Pentagon, all the party invitations on the Georgetown circuit would dry up. He would be persona non grata in all the worlds that mattered to him, the New York and Washington and Boston chattering classes.
Yeah, but you know, he was anyway. He was just, well, you go into that in the book where he goes in one day and Johnson doesn't have anything for him to do.
Well, but that's different. So, yes, he immediately is iced out by LBJ because LBJ knows that he's a Kennedy guy and that he doesn't want this Kennedy intellectual hanging around the White House. So LBJ isolates him right away, and you know, Schlesinger gets the message, and he resigns. He's one of the first Kennedy guys to leave the Johnson administration. But that's different from the sort of circles that meant everything to Schlesinger. I'm talking about the Harvard-Cambridge circles. I'm talking about the New York media circles and party scene. I'm talking about the Washington power scene, you know. and he desperately wanted to remain part of those worlds. And so he intellectually knew that Kennedy had been killed by a conspiracy, but he couldn't go all the way and publicly say that. So that's why on his deathbed, he tells his son, who tells me this, that he says, "Dad, do you have any regrets about anything you didn't write? Is there a book that you would have liked to write that you didn't?" He goes, "Yes, I should have written a book about the CIA because it undermined our democracy." Well, he's clearly saying that at that point, you know, in his life as he's dying. And, you know, he couldn't bring himself all the way to confront the CIA, which I knew, which I strongly suspect he felt was behind the murder of the president.
If he would have done what Len is saying he should have done, he probably justified it in his own mind. The New York Times would have never asked me to review John Newman's book on the cover of their book review thing. And he actually gave it a pretty good review.
Mm-hmm. I think he walked a line, you know. He also endorsed, in a way, Anthony Summers' book, didn't he? I think he gave him a blurb, too, on his book Conspiracy.
Yeah, I think he did. I think you're right about that, yes.
And he met with Oliver Stone, you know, and Oliver was getting all this heat after JFK came out. But, of course, then in his diaries, he kind of dismisses Stone, too. But at least he was talking to these people, the researchers who were doing the best work. And he was keeping an open mind, and I think he knew they were right. But he himself didn't have the courage to go all the way and write something that could have actually, at least within those intellectual and liberal circles where he still was an important voice, it could have had an impact.
Well, I'm harder on him than you were. I think you're making a case for him.
Oh, I thought I was pretty hard on him, but maybe, you know, I could have gone after him more.
No, you don't have to.
I basically call him a coward, and that's what I think he was. He was an intellectual coward.
Yeah. No, now you're in the ballpark now. That's good, because so many people on the other side of the, you know, the lone assassin side, well, you know, who would have talked? Look at Schlesinger. And you know, and then when people, you know, talk down about a movie, about Oliver Stone's movie, I mean, you're getting into the Jim Garrison story, really. There's someone who tried to do something, and that's courage there, Jim Garrison. You know,
people love to bash Oliver because that somehow proved that they were, like, you know, much more hard-headed and, you know, and grounded in fact, which is bullshit. It was like they went after Oliver because they were cowards themselves. And Oliver was opening the doors to, you know, all these skeletons that they found deeply disturbing.
Well, he's exposing cowards in the media.
He's exposing the cowards who didn't do their job at the same time. Right. I mean, look, the American media, you know, I have to say, after a lifetime in it and after writing these two books on the Kennedy story, I just have complete contempt for it. I mean, it's all I can do to even talk to some of these reporters who call me up, because either they're completely stupid and they have done no work themselves and they're lazy and ignorant, or they're, you know, they have some agenda. They're, you know, they're an asset in some way or another for the agencies who want to keep covering this up. So, you know, the American media, I mean, whenever they do stumble on a big story, it's usually they're stumbling on it or it's being leaked to them. And then they give each other awards and pat each other on the back. But whenever there is some kind of breakthrough, usually an investigative breakthrough, it's as a result of an internal government conflict that leaks into the media. So, I mean, you know, the amount of true enterprise reporting, investigative reporting that's courageous and original, you know, you can count on one hand those stories in probably our whole lifetime.
Yeah. Now, I have one other question just to elaborate on this. So, do you think that there can be a part two to this? Do you think that there's enough meat here for researchers to continue this trail of Alan Dulles being behind the assassination?
Well, you know, I'm still a believer that CIA is sitting on those documents, those 1,100-some documents that they're withholding, that Jeff Morley's been going after for years. They're sitting on those for a reason. So, yeah, I mean, I think if we ever pry those loose or someone leaks them, we need Ned Snowden, frankly. I mean, you know, those documents, I guess, are sitting in NARA, in the archives. Someone could leak them. And, you know, I publicly call on someone, a conscientious person who works in the archives, to leak them, because that would be abiding by the federal law. The CIA is now obstructing justice. They're obstructing the JFK Records Act. So I call on government officials who have access to those documents to release them. Yeah, under law, under federal law. So, yeah, if we get our hands on those, that probably will shed some new lights. Maybe we'll see what William Harvey's, where he was traveling in November 1963 for sure, and things like that.
Right, because you mentioned the media. I think in the book or in an interview, you talked about Don Hewitt of 60 Minutes going into this, and then they decided to drop the whole thing because they got orders from upstairs that we're not going to cover this story, even though there's a lot of, well, can you just elaborate on that? Is that in the book? Or was did no, you?
Yeah, that was in Brothers. But again, that speaks to what I was saying earlier. The elites knew the truth. The elites, the ones who were plugged in and had, you know, half a brain, could figure this out really quickly. There was a conspiracy to kill Kennedy. It was just too absurd, the whole thing. This guy who couldn't shoot straight with a bad gun, you know, pulls off the marksmanship feat of the century, you know, and then is quickly silenced himself by some mafia errand boy. I mean, it was all just absurd. And anyone, you know, could just see that. The American people saw it instinctually right away. So the elites were all telling each other this. Yeah, it was a conspiracy. Don Hewitt, when I interview him, one of the top investigative names in American journalism, the creator of 60 Minutes, basically said, yeah, I knew it was a conspiracy and probably was. Involved CIA guys and mafia and you know, Cuban exiles. That's what he told me. It's in Brothers. And I said, well, why didn't you pursue it? Why didn't you break the case? He goes, oh, well, we never could find enough, you know. That's the, you know, again, they always excuses for why they didn't do their jobs. Ben Bradley, I sat down with, probably who was the closest person in the Washington press corps to President Kennedy, frequent guest, he and his wife at the White House. They were pals, and he wrote a whole book about this, right, how good buddies they were. Well, I said, why didn't you, like, try to solve your good buddy's murder? You know, I sat down with Ben at the Washington Post, where he still had an office after he retired as executive editor. And at least he had the guts or the honesty or whatever to tell me basically the truth. He goes, well, it probably would end my career because people knew I was close to JFK and they would have thought I was obsessive and this and that. And that's probably true. It would have ended his career. But he, I'm sure, knew, could put two and two together, and he knew probably generally what had happened. But the Washington Post, again, massive failure to, and even they, you know, because the Post usually goes behind government investigations. That's how they get really brave and people start leaking during these investigations. They had the opportunity of a lifetime during the House Select Committee on Assassinations and the Church Committee to go behind those government investigations and do their own original work. Instead, they sort of, you know, they play the opposite role often in the New York Times and Washington Post. They criticize the investigations. They made trouble for the members of Congress who were involved in them. They undermine them. So it's cowardice. I mean, and at least Bradley had the honesty to admit it.
Getting back to Len's point about Schlesinger. See, Len, you tried to compare Schlesinger with Garrison. But what people leave out is that Garrison's career was destroyed.
I didn't try to compare him. I just said that Garrison was courageous and Schlesinger, upon my reflection, is gutless.
Well, but that's a very big, big decision to make. I mean, do I want to burn the rest of my career like this Jim Garrison guy who almost went to jail?
Well, what kind of career is it then?
Well, most people, I think what David's saying is that most people compromise their way out of it somehow, or they rationalize their way out of it somehow.
Exactly.
Yeah, but then
how many people do you know who are successful people self-immolate that way? I mean, it rarely happens.
Yeah.
Well, okay, I won't say what I'm thinking right now, but in that case, we have to commend David for writing about this.
Because for self-immolating.
I didn't want to say it. You did. Because I've heard, you know, researching this, some of the other interviews you've done on, and frankly, one host and a couple of people who called in, I mean, it's pathetic. This is almost an orchestrated effort to discredit some of your work, because the people who come up with these criticisms, in order to get this far into the case to name the things they're talking about, you have to have done research. And it just defies all logic to think someone can, you know, some of the questions you've had to face on other shows. I mean, it's... You know,
well, I think what the way that the CIA, and let's call it like it is, the CIA still, I think, runs a disinformation machine, and I still think they have an interest in the Kennedy case. They certainly did, you know, back in the 60s and 70s and so on. But I still think, you know, there's that machine is still in operation. I think what happened with Brothers is that the Bugliosi book, which was subsidized, I believe, there's no way that a publisher publishes over 1,000 pages like that without losing money. So I think that was a subsidized operation. Bugliosi had assistants writing it and putting it together. And I was told by my own publisher, Simon Schuster, that Bugliosi's book was actually, the pub date was changed to go right up against mine. So someone made that decision. It was a political decision. So what I faced then when I went out anywhere on the media circuit when Brothers came out was this pit bull, you know, prosecutor who was in my face and distracting attention, and that was the way they counter-programmed me. It's counter-programming is the way they operate. Or the other thing is Hollywood is very important to them. It's more important than books. And so the only reason I think they're really concerned about books is because they can trigger Hollywood films or TV series. And so I tell the story in Salon Magazine, what happened, my, you know, salon.com, what happened to me with Brothers in Hollywood. And, you know, what happened there was Lionsgate optioned it. They had it all set up to go. John Hamm at one point was going to play. He was very hot because Mad Men was really big. And it was their show. So they thought they had a great opportunity to set this up as a TV miniseries. And every network, even networks that initially were very excited, suddenly pulled the plug on it. And instead, what you had was Bugliosi's book, of course, that got optioned by Tom Hanks' production company. And I guess it eventually went through different iterations, but it turned into Parkland, right, Jim?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. So that's how they play that game. They are very well connected. The CIA has its own. I'm, in fact, putting out a book under my imprint, Hot Books, by Nick Scow, who wrote Kill the Messenger, about the CIA's continued manipulation of media in Hollywood. They have a very active office in Hollywood to control their image. And so now it's the same thing. There was a huge interest in Devil's Chessboard in Hollywood when it initially hit. It's a great epic story. And, of course, Hollywood's now fascinated by the dark side of power with series like House of Cards and the Game of Thrones and so on. So it was right up their alley. And, you know, we see with Spielberg's new movie, The Cold War, espionage is hot and all that. So it was a natural. George Clooney demanded a copy of the book, the advanced copy, the galleys. His agent drove it over to his house personally one weekend. And then when he realized what part three was all about, saying that, you know, Dulles was behind the assassination of the president, he flipped out because he knew that's a career ruiner. Same with other big names. Kevin Spacey looked at it, Brad Pitt, on and on. They all turned it down because I think it's the third rail for them. They don't want to be Oliver Stoned. Oliver Stone himself, who's become a friend over the last few years, you know, told me, David, they'll never make these books into a movie or a TV thing. And I think Oliver's correct. So that's the way they operate. They have their own rival projects. Those are the ones that get out. They also respond to books like mine by selectively leaking documents that supposedly are, you know, are hot stories and that distract the media. And so they did that by selectively leaking, you know, this internal parts of this internal CIA biography of John McCone that Phil Shannon and his credulity, former New York Times guy, ran with as the hottest story in the world. Well, I was all set up to be excerpted or to write a piece based on my book for Politico. In fact, one of the key people of Politico loved the book and called it a masterpiece. That was his words in an email to me, and it was all set up. And then at the last minute, the editor there pulled the plug on my book and said, no, we're going to run this Phil Shannon thing instead. You know, I was set up to, be interviewed on Al Jazeera America, even pulled the plug on me at the last minute. I was literally in a car in Manhattan on the way to the studio to be interviewed. And my publicist got a phone call and said, no, it's been canceled. And he was stunned. And he said, what do you mean? And he emailed the producer at Al Jazeera. And he got a one-word reply back. And that word was politics.
Wow.
So,
what a revelation.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, it's a war. It's a war of ideas. I'm not demoralized by this. I'm Irish. I love a fight. I know it's a fight, right? And it's fighting, as Ishmael Reed once said. And, you know, our people like you and me, we're in a war. And we're losing the war, frankly. I mean, ever since JFK, since Oliver, you know, sort of turned the tide briefly, I hope that Devil's Chessboard sort of further emboldens our side and we take, you know, sort of the momentum back a little bit. I have a saying that the best story in the war of ideas wins. So I put a lot of effort into the way I wrote this book. So it would be a gripping read. It can be sort of positioned as a great spy epic, because it is in a way.
Well, it's a history lesson as well.
Yeah, as well as a history lesson. But, I mean, I want to affect public opinion. And so, you know, I am being blocked by the media gatekeepers here and there. But they can't stop everything. It's like water through the cracks of stones. There is an alternative media, thank God, still. There are programs like yours, Len. There's, you know, Salon. There's Mother Jones. There's Democracy Now! And Amy Goodman. There's local radio. You know, local radio has been amazing. And shows like Coast to Coast, you know, that go across the country nationally. Or Pacific.
Oh, my God, I heard that Coast to Coast one.
Yeah.
What about that last caller?
You know, so you got some loony callers there, but whatever. I mean, you know, it's a way of reaching people. And it's a populist way of reaching people, and I have no problem being on any of those shows to get the word out. And so now the book has become a bestseller in California, and that's
good.
Right in their face.
Yeah,
and
congratulations.
I take great delight in that.
Jim, I know we have both had a lot of questions. I don't know if we'll be able to get to them all today. Do you have?
Yeah, Len, I probably should go maybe 10 more minutes.
Yeah, sure. That's what I was just going to ask Jim, if there was a few things he wanted to bring up.
Okay. I think one thing that I thought was very fascinating, if you follow the story, you have Dulles in Bern sort of beginning the Cold War. Then he comes back, and the book has a very, very fascinating chapter on Dulles, Nixon, and Alger Hiss.
Right.
Okay, and it's sort of the way you depict it, sort of like the Dulles brothers were the guys in the back room, both encouraging and manipulating Nixon in his pursuit of Alger Hiss.
That is accurate. I think that's a really important and fascinating transitional period in American history, because you have this really critical transition from FDR's Washington and the New Deal era to, you know, the Dulles and Eisenhower era, with sort of Truman being this transitional presidency in between. And what was happening there was a political war over the future of the country. As I say, if Roosevelt and the New Deal, say Henry Wallace, had been, you know, sort of had continued the Roosevelt era, it would have been so vastly different. There may not have been a Cold War. Certain people like the Dulles brothers might have even been brought to justice. There would have been a public accounting of what had happened, the collaboration with the Nazis and so on. But the Dulles brothers and that wing of the Republican Party were brilliant, and they realized that the anti-communist witch hunt and that fervor that they were ginning up and generating after the war, you know, basically saying the New Deal was riddled with communist spies, which was absurd. You know, that was their weapon that they used to purge Washington of those elements that were threats to them. And it was hugely effective. And of course, you know, of course, Stalin and the Soviet Union played into their hands as well. Paranoid, you know, despot in the Soviet Union, I'm not saying was all sort of a creation of Dulles, the Cold War. But he certainly, that wing of the Republican Party certainly exploited it in a masterful way. And one of the people that they do create and impose on America, I believe, is Richard Nixon. He is a creation of the sort of Dulles Dewey wing of the Republican Party. They sponsored his first run against Jerry Forrest. And Jerry Forrest was, you know, a young congressman from Southern California who was sort of one of the leading symbols in Congress of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. He'd been a socialist and a union activist and had some very radical, innovative ideas about what to do with the American economy and how to extend Social Security as a sort of a social safety net. And he wanted to nationalize the banks, and he wanted to go after the oil industry, and he was their worst nightmare. You know, Republican corporate America is the worst nightmare. So he was a target in any case, and they were able to get two birds with one stone by running this young Dick Nixon against Forrest, knocking the new dealer out, and then Nixon becomes their weapon, this, you know, this witch hunting weapon who begins to purge Washington as a whole of the New Deal legacy.
And it, of course, historically speaking, it was really Nixon's pursuit of Alger Hiss and his success in getting him indicted and convicted. That really encouraged McCarthy. So this really began the whole Red Scare, too, the second Red Scare.
Absolutely. It just takes off from there. And then McCarthy, of course, becomes his own Frankenstein and even threatens Eisenhower and Dulles. And then he has to be dealt with. And we always think, oh, it was the Army-McCarthy hearings that finally brought down McCarthy, which is true. But the person who drew first blood was Joe McCarthy, who really went after him at first and started to defeat him, was Alan Dulles. And I tell that story in the book.
Yeah, because this is ironic. It's because Dulles won't turn over Bill Bundy, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, he keeps coming after every department institution in Washington. You know, his brother Foster caves under the McCarthy assault and gives McCarthy basically everything he wants and purges the State Department of just about every, you know, its best and brightest, basically. And then he comes after the CIA, and Alan says, no, that ain't going to happen. I control the CIA, you know, fuck off. And McCarthy rages and throws a tantrum, but Alan Dulles basically backs him down. And I think, you know, there was hardball played there, because I think, you know, they had compiled a lot of dirt on McCarthy by then, his sexual proclivities and all of that, and they were prepared to do whatever they needed to do to defeat him. This is the CIA. So it was Alan Dulles who began the downfall of Joe McCarthy.
All right, that's it for me, Len.
Okay,
thanks.
Good. Well, I've got two last questions, and one I was going to ask. What was the most surprising fact about Alan Dulles that you discovered?
That's too big, Len.
There wasn't one that was just
too
surprising?
I think we talked about so many of them. I can't pinpoint just one. You know.
Okay, fine. Yeah. But my last question then was just maybe a brief comment about, you know, when Truman wrote about that Frankenstein article, you discussed a little bit how Dulles actually changed the record. And I think you alluded to it earlier, but this is the fact. If he couldn't get his way, he would just go back and report something different. I mean, he met with Truman, and Truman wouldn't back down from the article, correct?
Right. Well, you see, this is the way that intelligence, you know, agencies often operate. I mean, basically, John Newman has written a whole book, at least one book or more now, I guess, on how they did it with Oswald. You create a legend. You create a documentary record about something in order to alter reality itself. And so Oswald becomes one thing in the files and something else in real life. So, yeah, what happened was Truman writes this bombshell of an op-ed in the Washington Post during the very emotionally fraught days right after Kennedy's assassinated. And there it is in bold print in the Washington Post. The former president of the United States who created the CIA, Harry Truman, is writing that the CIA is out of control and that not only is it threatening democracy overseas, but a democracy at home. And what are people to make of this in the days right after Kennedy's killed? So Alan Dulles flies into action. He tries to get Clark Clifford, who's a Washington power broker, who's close to Harry Truman, to lean on Truman to get him to retract the piece. But that doesn't succeed. Truman, of course, is famously stubborn. So Dulles flies down to Independence, Missouri himself to meet with Truman. And again, you know, wheedles and pressures him and tries to get him to take back this piece, saying, look, it was you who created the CIA. You certainly wanted it to be an aggressive thing, but Harry Truman will have none of it. You know, he stands by his piece. So he comes home, Dulles, to Washington. And what does he do? He writes a letter to the general counsel, Lawrence Houston of the CIA, and says, you know what, I talked to Harry Truman, and it seems like he really didn't know what he was writing, or it was written by somebody else, one of his aides, and, you know, presents this picture of Truman as if he's the senile guy who has been either manipulated somehow or didn't even know, sort of think through the consequences of what he was writing. And that goes into the CIA files, and you can still see when you sort of, you know, Google this and look into this online, that there's then this, it takes on a life of its own. It becomes the CIA official version of what happened. Oh, yeah, Harry Truman was manipulated somehow, and he didn't really mean to write this. And so that's out there now. Dulles was the guy who set that in motion.
But Truman reaffirmed what he thought in his letter to Look magazine, right?
He did. He reaffirmed at least twice that I referred to. One was in a letter to Look, and one was to the former CIA director.
Sowers.
Yeah, who had congratulated Harry Truman on this op-ed piece, and Truman writes back saying, yes, you know what I was saying was correct, because that was what we intended the CIA to be, just an intelligence gathering agency and not this kind of covert action rogue agency that's going around the world doing all these sinister things. So, yeah, I mean, clearly he intended to write it. He stuck by it, and he continued to stick by it despite what Dulles was saying.
Well, the thing that impressed me about that incident, that if Alan Dulles was retired, why would he have to fly out there to do this? And, I mean, he's still behind pulling all the strings.
Yeah, he's still the main advocate. He's still the guy who's the godfather of that agency.
Right.
And he's the old man. In other words, he's the affectionate god, you know, as he's affectionately referred to by the CIA old boy network. He's the guy that they all look to. And so this is, I'll leave you with just this final thing. This essentially is what I came to conclude, that I do believe to a certain extent in the great man theory of government. Dulles didn't operate on his own. It wasn't. I'm not trying to say, like some people have said, that he's just somehow this evil Superman. He operated within a system of power, and that's why I write about C. Wright Mills, the great sociologist who wrote The Power Elite. C. Wright Mills was onto this at the time. He was analyzing Dulles' people within this as members of a system of power that included the key security officials, included corporate figures, included people on Wall Street. So Dulles only operated, I think, on major issues when he felt there was a consensus within the circle. But at the same time, I've now, at this point in my life, after running a company myself, after dealing with business people and being in the political world, and seeing, frankly, how history was changed with the assassinations of the Kennedys and Martin Luther King, I've come to appreciate how individual leaders who have unique abilities and unique connections and are uniquely persuasive can actually affect history in a major way. And Alan Dulles was one of those people. He was someone who was uniquely connected throughout those power circles. He was connected in the Wall Street world, and he was connected in the corporate world. He was connected in the national security world. He was connected to overseas interests, and he was like Dick Cheney on steroids. And so when he came forward and said, look, this president has to be removed for the good of the country, he's an aberrant president, he's a weak president, he's putting the country at risk, he was one of the guys who could develop, one of, maybe the only political figure at that time who did have the connections, the gravitas, the stature within that power elite to make something like this happen. And so there's no other person, I think, who fits that kind of criteria. And again, I'm not saying he acted on his own. I'm saying that he was a very key central figure within this power network. And when he finally made the decision, the old man will take care of it, as the Russian priest said at the party where Peter Dale Scott was, that, you know, instilled confidence in everyone. And for CIA officials and operatives to know that the old man was behind this, that gave them the blessing that they needed. So anyway, that's what I'm going to leave you with.
All right.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah, The Devil's Chessboard, and you recommend people buy it at an independent bookstore.
Absolutely. Independent bookstores first. And maybe I'll see you in Dallas if you're both going there.
Okay.
All right.
I'll be there in November.
Are you speaking there?
Yeah, I'm going to be speaking at the JFK Lancer conference this year. Great.
All right, thank you very much.
Thanks, Lan. Thanks,
okay.
Jim.
Okay.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.